welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles, and I admit it, I'm a sucker for stories about misfits. Today, we'll look at folks who don't quite fit in and never did. We'll preview tales that pack both heart and the punches that hit us squarely in our emotional center. It's no mystery why these tales truly resonate with us. At one time or another, we've all felt we were on the outside looking in. Our guest today, the popular Australian author Laura Moriarty, rocketed up last year's bestseller list with The Husband's Secret. Today, she'll fill us in on her new title, Big Little Lies. So, if you've ever felt at odds with your pals, your family, or the world around you, get ready to enjoy this eclectic group of titles. We'll turn now to page one of the book report. Beyond the skyline of Toledo stands the Toledo Institute of Astronomy, the nation's premier center of astronomical discovery and beacon of scientific learning. George Dermont, a dreamer and a man of deep faith, is trying to prove the scientific existence of a gateway to God. He speaks to ancient gods and believes they speak back. Irene Sparks is a pragmatist and a mathematician invited to lead the Institute's work on a massive superconductor. When Irene returns to Toledo, she sets in motion a series of events which place her and George on a collision course with love, destiny, and fate. Lydia Netzer's How to Tell Toledo from the Night Sky is a mind-bending, heart-shattering love story for dreamers and pragmatists alike. Jocelyn Jackson narrates.
The Toledo Institute of Astronomy was founded in 1837 as the Stickney Library of Almanacs, or Almanacs, by Angelica Stickney, whose family's fortune had been made in shipping and whose lifelong passion was observing the night sky. She employed two full-time academics in her library. The more elderly of them, Dr. Claude Pooley, had been hired to study and catalog the information in Mrs. Stickney's astonishing collection of almanacs, from a tablet of Sumerian origin depicting planetary movements to a document from the 16th century that was believed to have been penned by Francis Bacon. The other scientist in her employ, self-taught female prodigy Esther Burchard, was charged with studying stars and weather patterns in order to better inform the decisions made by the Stickney family's transportation business, which operated largely on the Miami and Erie Canal and its Wabash extension. Burchard's husband was an elevator man. He was a naturally suspicious person. Pooley, the librarian, enlightened by the study of ancient texts and tables, became involved in light experiments postulating the chemical composition of the sun. He had such success with his observations that he began to publish his work and bring in other researchers to work with him. On the other side of this dual operation, Stickney carriers laid unfortunate claim to the record for most vessels lost in the river to storms, mechanical failures, and crime. Esther Burchard, whose job it was to advise the captains of these boats, grew more and more reclusive as her predictions increasingly failed. Year by year, she found herself relying less on her anemometer and more on fervent prayer to improve the fates of the company. Eventually, she lost her job. When pressed to account for this, Angelica Stickney calmly explained that Esther Burchard was a weather witch and had accordingly been banished from the company. Her husband almost immediately fell down an elevator shaft and died, leaving behind a curt note to his children that his wife was not to blame. Esther Burchard was not seen or heard from again. Angelica's son, Harold Stickney, a prescient man who anticipated both the decline of canals and the importance of the scientific work being done at the library, wisely sold off the family's interest in the shipping industry and poured the family's fortune into establishing a college of science in the swampy country north of the river. He dreamed of founding a mecca of learning and culture to rival the East Coast universities. They had a 200-year jump on him, but no more zeal for learning and truth. His motto was Scientia Vincere Tenebras, or conquering the darkness through science. And at this humble academic outpost on the Maumee River, Stickney and Poole planted a flag for reason. Deep in the woods, Esther Burchard whistled up a wind. Almost 200 years later, the Toledo Institute of Astronomy had fully emerged as the epicenter of knowledge and research that its founders had imagined. Its lecture halls and laboratories were well-funded by interested corporations, its trust well-endowed by generous individuals, its campus a glorious example of frontier classicism, and in 1992, its reach even extended into space, as the first Toledo Space Telescope had been launched into orbit via space shuttle. The city of Toledo was proud of its astronomers, proud of its status, standing shoulder to shoulder with Brussels or Shanghai or Sydney in the quest to unlock the secrets of the universe and plumb the depths of the history of stars.
That was How to Tell Toledo from the Night Sky by Lydia Netzer. Leanne Moriarty is the Australian author of 5 bestsellers, including last summer's The Husband's Secret, which has sold over 1 million copies in the United States alone. Leanne began her career in advertising and marketing. After that, she worked as a freelance advertising copywriter, writing everything from websites and TV commercials to the back of brand boxes. She also wrote short stories and many first chapters of novels that didn't go any further. But luckily for her devoted fans, all that has changed. Today we'll speak with Leanne about her new title, Big Little Lies. Welcome, Leanne. It's wonderful to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you so much.
Big Little Lies focuses on 3 moms whose kids attend the same kindergarten. Can you introduce us to Madeline, Celeste, and Jane?
Sure. So Madeline, I'll start with Madeline, probably because she's my favorite. She was a lot of fun to write. She's one of those women who is always outraged over something. So and she's a fiercely loyal friend, but she's always involved in some sort of conflict with somebody or something. And she's very good friends with Celeste, who's one of those impossibly beautiful women who, so she's the sort that when she walks into the schoolyard or the other school dads trip over the kids' bags as they take a second look at her. And from the outside, it appears that she's leading a perfect life. But of course, that doesn't make very interesting reading, so she's not. She's got some secrets of her own. And the final character, who's new to this little seaside town where the book is set, called the Piriwee Peninsula, she moves into the area with her little boy, and she's a single mum, and her name's Jane, and she's a very shy, reserved person with secrets of her own. So then the 3 of them become good friends, and it all starts from there.
So the parents at this school are like the PTA on steroids. I'm guessing you might have small children?
Yes, I became a school mum for the first time myself last year, when I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. So I have only just recently become part of this this world of the school parent. So it's fascinating to me. It's like becoming part of a small village. And as somebody else said, it's almost like returning to high school too. So it's all the cool groups and the not so cool groups, and except that these days we all pretend we don't care if we're not part of the cool group.
Right. I'm hoping your children's school is not anything like the one described in Big Little Lies.
It's absolutely absolutely nothing like, nothing like it. Really isn't. And in fact, everybody, as I said in the acknowledgements, the parents are disappointingly well behaved. They are all, they genuinely are really lovely people. But I think becoming a school mum showed me the potential, and the schoolyard to me just has so much potential for conflict and drama.
Right. Your children are young, yet you really nailed the tension, angst, and aggravation of mother versus teenage daughter. How did you get it so right?
Oh, that's good to hear. I have got friends with teenage daughters, so I'm sure I hope I'm not stealing too much of their lives. I'm sure I'm taking that in as I listen to them. But apart from that, it's imagining. Although, to be honest, my little girl, she's only four, but she sure sounds like a teenager sometimes. So it's not that hard to imagine what it's going to be like with her. I'm sure from friends I've picked up all the new worries over Facebook and that sort of thing. So I have no experience of all that. That's ahead of me.
Right. Your story breezes along with entertaining characters and dialogue, yet it tackles two very tough issues. What led you to spotlight domestic violence and bullying?
I never set out to... I'm not a planner of my book, so I knew I had... I started with the premise of a school trivia night that goes terribly wrong, and then I had to go back in time to work out what series of events led to that night. So I never set out to say, okay, I'm going to write about those two particular issues. It just somehow seemed to evolve.
Let's talk about story structure for a moment. You interject sort of gossipy quotes from lesser characters. What brought you to use this innovative technique?
Thank you. It came about by accident, actually, because originally I'd planned to write the whole book as if it was being told by the three main characters to somebody else. So one of those story within a story, so as if a journalist was writing the story of what had happened. But then I felt that I was too removed from the characters doing it that way. But because I had sort of enjoyed... I'd enjoyed it, writing it in that way. So that's when I then came up the idea of having lots of the other little characters interspersed throughout. So, and then it was a lot of fun writing it. So I enjoyed that.
It was a lot of fun reading it, too. Your last book, The Husband's Secret, was such a phenomenon. How did that impact the writing process of this book? Did it add additional pressure?
It didn't, because I always find it really hard to remember the process of writing my books, but I think I must have been well into it by the time The Husband's Secret came out. So, and once I'm into a story, then I'm just enjoying writing it, so I want to see what happens. So I really didn't think too much about the success of The Husband's Secret. So I'm more concerned about how that will affect the next one. I haven't as yet really got any ideas for that. But I'm hoping, again, once I get going, I'll be okay and I can put that aside. But, yeah, certainly it brings pressure. But I guess that the other thing is that it wasn't like it was my debut novel, so... I think that's when authors find they struggle with their next novel if they had a huge success. So it's nice not to be an overnight success. You know, this is my sixth novel, so I know I can write another one.
Right. You come from a writing family. Tell us about your sisters.
So I'm the eldest of six children, and three of us are published writers. So... even though I'm the eldest, I wasn't first. It was actually my next sister down. She was the first one. So we both wanted to be writers when we were little. But then as I grew up, I sort of lost confidence in myself as a writer. And I ended up going into advertising and marketing, and I was actually a freelance advertising copywriter. On the day that I got the call from my sister to say that her first novel had been accepted, And so, although I was thrilled for her, I was also very, very envious. So it was thanks to her that, I probably began writing that very day, that I finally finished writing my first novel, which was Three Wishes. And then our youngest sister, many years later, she also wrote her first novel.
You also write a series for children. Fill us in on that.
I do. I don't talk about that as much because they haven't done as well. And in fact, the third in that series ended on a cliffhanger. So I do sometimes get emails from little girls saying, it appears like that the main character's in grave danger. Is there going to be a new book? Is she going to stay in grave danger? And I have to say, I'm sorry. The books didn't sell that well. She has to stay. You don't sort of virtually hanging from that, dangling from that cliff forever. I had a lot of fun writing that series. So I was sad that they haven't done as well as the adult books.
So I know you said you haven't started writing yet, but are the ideas for the new novel formulating in your mind?
Well, I've been joking a lot, saying that I think I should set my next book on a tropical island, and that I need to do a lot of research to get my setting exactly right. But it's funny, since I've been making this joke so often that it's actually started to sort of stick in my mind, thinking this could actually work as a setting for a new novel. So, because it would give that, in the same way that the schoolyard in Big Little Lies is, a confined environment, so would a tropical island. So why not? But that's really as far as I've got.
All right. Well, any final thoughts about Big Little Lies?
No, just I hope that readers enjoy it, and so far they are saying all the things that I hope they'd say, so it's a great pleasure to hear from them.
All right. Well, Leanne, I really enjoyed reading your book, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
And now, let's listen to a sample of Big Little Lies, performed by Caroline Lee.
Mothers took their mothering so seriously now. Their frantic little faces, their busy little bottoms strutting into the school in their tight gym gear, ponytails swinging, eyes fixed on the mobile phones held in the palms of their hands like compasses. It made Mrs. Ponder laugh. Fondly, though, her three daughters were exactly the same, and they were all so pretty. "How are you this morning?" she always called out if she was on the front porch with a cup of tea or watering the front garden as they went by. "Busy, Mrs. Ponder, frantic," they always called back, trotting along, yanking their children's arms. They were pleasant and friendly and just a touch condescending, because they couldn't help it. She was so old. They were so busy. The fathers, and there were more and more of them during the school run these days, were different. They rarely hurried, strolling past with a measured casualness. No big deal. All under control. That was the message. Mrs. Ponder chuckled fondly at them, too. But now it seemed the Pirrawee public parents were misbehaving. She got to the window and pushed aside the lace curtain. The school had recently paid for a window guard after a year three boy's cricket ball had smashed the glass and nearly knocked out Marie Antoinette. A group of them had given her a hand-painted apology card, which she kept on her fridge. There was a two-story sandstone building on the other side of the playground, with an event room on the second level and a big balcony with ocean views. Mrs. Ponder had been there for a few functions, a talk by a local historian, a lunch hosted by the Friends of the Library. It was quite a beautiful room. Sometimes ex-students had their wedding receptions there. That's where they'd be having the school trivia night. They were raising funds for smart boards, whatever they were. Mrs. Ponder had been invited as a matter of course, Her proximity to the school gave her a funny sort of honorary status, even though she'd never had a child or grandchild attend. She'd said no thank you to the school trivia night invitation. She thought school events without the children in attendance were pointless. The children had their weekly school assembly in the same room. Each Friday morning, Mrs. Ponder set herself up in the sewing room with a cup of English breakfast and a ginger nut biscuit. The sound of the children singing floating down from the second floor of the building always made her weep. She'd never believed in God, except when she heard children singing. There was no childish singing now. Mrs. Ponder could hear a lot of bad language. She wasn't a prude about bad language. Her eldest daughter swore like a trooper, but it was upsetting and disconcerting to hear someone maniacally screaming that particular four-letter word in a place that was normally filled with childish laughter and shouts. "Are you all drunk?" she said. Her rain-splattered window was at eye level with the entrance doors to the building, and suddenly people began to spill out. Security lights illuminated the paved area around the entrance like a stage set for a play. Clouds of mist added to the effect. It was a strange sight. The parents at Piriwee Public had a baffling fondness for costume parties. It wasn't enough that they should have an ordinary trivia night. She knew from the invitation that some bright spark had decided to make it an Audrey and Elvis trivia night, which meant that the women all had to dress up as Audrey Hepburn and the men had to dress up as Elvis Presley. That was another reason Mrs. Ponder had turned down the invitation. She'd always abhorred costume parties.
We've just heard Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty. Laura McBride's We Are Called to Rise is set near Las Vegas, where four lives are brought together by one split-second choice. In the pre-dawn hours, a woman's marriage crumbles with a single confession. Across town, an immigrant family struggles to fit in and get by in their new land. 3,000 miles away, a soldier wakes up in Walter Reed Hospital with the vague feeling he's done something awful. In a single moment, these disparate lives intersect. Faced with seemingly insurmountable loss, each person must decide whether to give in to despair or find the courage to carry on. An ensemble cast performs the book.
There was a year of no desire. I don't know why. Margot said I was depressed. Jill thought it was the change. That phrase made me laugh. I didn't think I was depressed. I still grinned when I saw the roadrunner waiting to join me on my morning walk. I still stopped to look at the sky when fat clouds piled up against the blue, or in the evenings when it streaked orange and purple in the west. Those moments did not feel like depression. But I didn't desire my husband, and there was no certain reason for it. And as the months went by, the distance between us grew. I tried to talk myself out of this, but my body would not comply. Finally, I decided to rely on what in my case would be mother wisdom, or as Charlene would say, to fake it till you make it. That night, I eased myself out of bed carefully, not wanting to fully wake Jim. I had grown up in Las Vegas. Grown up seeing women prance around in sparkling underwear, learned how to do the same, prancing in the same underwear when I was barely 15. But years of living in another Las Vegas, decades of being a suburban wife, a mother, a woman of a certain social standing, had left me uneasy with sequined bras and crotchless panties. My naughty underwear drawer was still there, the long, narrow one on the left side of my dresser, but I couldn't even remember the last time I had opened it. My heart skipped a little when I imagined slipping on a black lace corset and kneeling over Jim in bed. Well, I had made a decision, and I was going to do it. I would not give up on 29 years of marriage without at least trying this. So I padded quietly over to the dresser and eased open the narrow drawer. I was expecting the bits of lace and satin, even sequins, but nestled among them, obscenely, was a gun. It made me gasp. How had a gun gotten in this drawer? I recognized it, though. Jim had given it to me when Emily was a baby. He had insisted that I keep a gun, because he traveled, because someone might break in. I had tried to explain that I would never use it. I wouldn't aim a gun at someone any more than I would drown a kitten. There were decisions I had made about my life a long time ago. Firing a gun was on that list. But there were things Jim could not hear me say, and in the end, it was easier just to accept the gun, just to let him hide it in one of those silly fake books on the third shelf of the closet, where if I had thought about it, and I never did, I would have assumed it still was. How long had the gun been in this drawer? Had Jim put it there? Was he sending a message? Had Jim wanted to make the point that I hadn't looked in this drawer for years? Hadn't worn red sequined panties in years? Had Jim been thinking the same way I had? That maybe what we needed was a little romance, a little fun, a little hot sex in the middle of the kitchen in order to start over? I could hear Jim stirring behind me. He would be looking at me, naked in front of our sex drawer. Things weren't going exactly the way I had intended, but I shook my bottom a little, just to give him a hint at what I was doing. He coughed. I stopped then, not sure what that cough meant. I didn't even want to touch the gun, but I carefully eased the closest bit of satin out from under the barrel, still thinking that I would find a way to slip it on and maybe dance my way back to the bed. I'm in love with Darcy. We've been seeing each other for a while. Was he confessing to an affair? Had he just said he was in love with her?
That was We Are Called to Rise by Laura McBride. In Jennifer Weiner's All Fall Down, Allison Weiss is a typical working mom, trying to balance a business, aging parents, a demanding daughter, and her marriage. But when the website she develops takes off, she becomes completely overwhelmed. Her husband is becoming distant, her daughter's acting spoiled, her father is dealing with early Alzheimer's, and her mother is barely dealing at all. As she struggles to hold it all together and meet the needs of the people around her, Allison finds the painkillers she was prescribed for a back injury help her deal with more than just physical discomfort. Sure, she worries the bottles seem to empty a bit faster each week, but it's not like she's some Hollywood starlet. It's not as if she has an actual problem. When Allison can no longer control or hide her dependency, she ends up in rehab. Amid the teenage heroin addicts, alcoholic grannies, and counselors who believe one mode of recovery fits all, Allison struggles to get her life back on track. Sparkling with a deft comedic touch and tender, true-to-life characterizations, readers find this title a tale of empowerment and redemption. Tracy Chimo narrates.
I am having an idea. Maybe we could tell the nurse lady that I have a sore throat now. I shook my head. Nah, we don't lie. Bad karma. Ellie considered this. I hate Carmel. She smoothed her skirt and wandered off to the toy basket. I recrossed my legs and checked out the crowd. The room was predictably full. There were first-time mothers from Queen Village and Society Hill who wore their babies, infants wrapped in yards of organic cotton, hand-dyed and woven by indigenous Peruvian craftswomen who were paid a living wage. The moms from Section 8 housing pushed secondhand strollers and fed their infants from plastic bottles, as opposed to ostentatiously breastfeeding or slipping the baby a few ounces of organic formula in a BPA-free bottle with a silicone-free nipple hidden under a prettily patterned, adorably named nursing cover-up
I'd worn one called the Hooter Hider. On the days when you use drugs or alcohol, do you usually have 3 drinks, doses, or more?
Define dose.
1 Percocet from the bottle I got after I had my wisdom teeth pulled? 2 Vicodin prescribed for a herniated disc I suffered in a step class at the gym? I'd never taken more than 2 of anything, except the day after my father had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and my mother had set up a temporary fortress in our guest room.
Could 3 pills count as a single dose?
I decided not to answer. Do you use drugs or alcohol to unwind or relax?
Hello, that's what they're for. And was that so bad, really? How many times had I heard my husband say, I need to go for a run? Or my best friend Janet say, I need a glass of wine. What I did was no different. It was actually better. A run was time-consuming and sweaty and hard on the joints, and wine could stain.
Mommy!
Hang on, sweetie, I said, as my iPhone rang in my purse. Just 1 minute.
You always say that. You always say just 1 minute, and it always takes you for hours.
Shh, I whispered before hurrying toward the door where I could keep an eye on her while I talked. Hi, Sarah. Allison, said Sarah in the gruff, all-business tone that surprised people, given her petite frame, sleek black bob, and freckled button nose. Did the fact-checker call? Not today. The Wall Street Journal was in the midst of its every 6 months rediscovery that women were online. They were doing a piece on women who blog, and ladiesroom.com, the website that I wrote for and Sarah ran, was to be featured. I was alternately giddy at the thought of how the publicity would raise Ladies Room's profile and nauseous at the notion of my picture in print.
She just read my quotes back to me, said Sarah. They sounded great. I've really got a good feeling about this.
Me too, I lied. I was optimistic about the piece, at least some of the time.
Mommy!
My daughter was standing about 6 inches from my face, brown eyes brimming, lower lip quivering. Gotta go, I told Sarah. We're at the doctor's.
Oh, God, is everything okay?
As okay as it ever is, I said, striving to inject good cheer into my tone before I slipped the phone back into my purse. Sarah, technically my boss, was 27 and childless. She knew I was a mother. That was, after all, why she'd hired me, to give readers live, from-the-trenches reports on married with children life. But I tried to be a model employee, who was always available to talk through edits or help brainstorm a headline, even if Ellie was with me. I also tried to be a model mother, making Ellie feel like she was the center of my universe, that I was entirely present for her, even when I was on the phone, debating, say, the use of strident versus emphatic, or arguing about which picture of Hillary Clinton to use to illustrate another will she or won't she run story.
That was a sampling of All Fall Down by Jennifer Weiner. Rufy Thorpe's The Girls from Corona Del Mar is a gripping novel about the bonds of friendships made in youth and how they either break or endure when challenged by loss, illness, parenthood, and distance. Mia and Lorianne have been lifelong friends. While Mia struggles with a mother who drinks, a pregnancy at 15, Lorianne is luminous, surrounded by her close-knit family, immune to the mistakes that mar her best friend's life. Then a sudden loss catapults Lorianne into tragedy. Things fall apart and then fall further, and there is nothing Mia can do to help. As good, brave, fair Lorianne stops being so very, very good, Mia begins to question who this woman is and what that question means about them both. Rebecca Lohman performs this deeply felt novel of family, motherhood, loyalty, and the myth of a perfect friendship.
He was a Christian rock musician, and Lorianne's mother, Dana, was a preschool teacher who collected gnomes. Ceramic and wooden gnomes of all sizes and styles, standing on the floor and on tables and shelves, their backs to the wall, their dull eyes turned on the center of the room. Certainly, it seemed to me, Lorianne would never have been stupid enough to get pregnant in 10th grade by a boy she didn't even like, which was precisely what I had done. And yet, the spring I was 15, it was Lorianne who came with me to get the abortion, who helped me to plan it all out. She had already turned 16 and gotten her license, but I didn't just need her as my driver. I needed her, in all her goodness and her primness, to forgive me, to give her consent by participating in my scheme. Trying to get an appointment at Planned Parenthood had been a nightmare. There wasn't any way I could reschedule, and I doubted I could play softball the very next day. I wanted Lorianne to break my toe so that I could show my coach a real and visceral damage. Also, in some strange way, I viewed the breaking of my toe as the price of the abortion itself, a way of reassuring myself that I was still a decent person. It was the punishment that makes the wicked good again. Though raised entirely without religion, I was somehow Catholic through temperament alone. "Just say you're sick," she insisted. "I don't like lying, and this is as close as I can get to making everything true." Lorianne looked at me dolefully. "You're nuts," she said. "You lie all the time." "Yes, and I hate it. It'll be fine. We'll get drunk and you'll just do it." It made a lot of intuitive, symbolic sense to force the beautiful, pure, and good Lorianne to break my toe and punish me for my abortion. To us, Lorianne's family was magic, and this magic transferred to Lorianne herself. It honeyed her golden hair and deepened the oceanic blue of her eyes. It made her upturned nose seem elegant instead of Irish. It was what made it sweet, not dorky, that Lorianne was the last girl in 6th grade to start shaving her legs. I think we were all jealous of those fine golden leg hairs, like a shimmer of fairy dust along Lorianne's calves. Why did it look so beautiful on her and so ugly and shameful on our own stolid little shins? Why did Lorianne look graceful in beat-up Keds and shorts a bit too small for her? Why was it charming when she snorted from laughing too hard? Yes, we were jealous of her, and yet we did not hate her. She was never so much as teased by us, we roaming and bratty girls of Corona Del Mar, thieves of corn nuts and orange soda, abusers of lip gloss and foul language, daughters to sham psychics and newly certified phlebotomists. And so, just after high school, when terrible things began to happen to Lorianne, we were all shocked. It was like some bizarre postmodern rendition of Job. We were transfixed, struck dumb, without access even to the traditional gestures of delivered casseroles and decent silences. The story of Lorianne became the thing stuck in our throats, keeping us quiet as we nervously chose careers and, with many doubts and superstitions, consented to marry the men we were in love with. All of our parents had gotten divorced. How could we fail to be afraid? All of our parents except, of course, Lorianne's.
We've just heard The Girls from Corona Del Mar by Rufy Thorpe. Heft by Liz Moore is a heartwarming tale about larger-than-life characters and second chances. It was a 2013 Audio Publishers Audi Award nominee for literary fiction. Former academic Arthur Opp weighs 550 pounds and hasn't left his rambling Brooklyn home in a decade. 20 miles away in Yonkers, 17-year-old Kel Keller navigates life as the poor kid in a rich school and pins his hopes on what seems like a promising baseball career. The link between this unlikely pair is Kel's mom, Charlene, a former student of Arthur's. After nearly two decades of silence, it is Charlene's unexpected phone call to Arthur, a plea for help, that jostles them into action. Through Arthur and Kel's own quirky and lovable voices, Heft tells the winning story of two improbable heroes whose sudden connection transforms both their lives. Kirby Hayborn and Keith Zarabaja perform the story of love and family found in the most unexpected places.
Once a week, I select my supplies on their website. They have everything, this company. Everything you could possibly think of. Prepared foods and raw ingredients. Desserts and breakfasts and wine and toilet paper. Cheese and deli meat and ice cream and cake and bagels and pop-ums. Little doughy confections that Entenmann's bakes. And then sprinkles with holiday-themed colors. Now it is October, and my pop-ums are orange and black. A man brings my food to my home on Tuesday nights. I made sure to choose the after 5 p.m. option when I joined, which pleases me. I like to think the delivery man might believe I work all day and I'm just getting home. I'm very silly in this way. On the phone with customer service representatives, I casually mention family or work. "How are you today, Mr. Opp?" asks the lady representative from Bank of America. And I sigh and say, "Swamped." A little joke. In the same way, I delight in answering the door for my grocery delivery with a tie loosened about my neck and an air of exhaustion and world-weary distractedness. "You can leave it just inside the door," I always say, and then walk into the kitchen, calling back over my shoulder little mundanities about the weather or a sports team. Once the boxes are all accounted for, I tip the driver with cash that I keep hidden in a drawer on my nightstand on the inside of a hollow book. I obtained the book as a child. It was my prized possession, a hollow book, and it has proven useful to me since. All the food I order for delivery is paid for by credit card on the phone. Tipping is the only thing I need cash for, so for a long time I have relied on the large store of bills that years ago I procured from the bank. I have no plan for when they run out. I never thought I'd need one. The very, very last time I went out of my house was in September of 2001, when I grew so lonesome watching the news that I opened my door and walked to the bottom of my stoop and sat on it, my head in my hands, for an hour. And I wished I had someone to talk to. It felt as if the world could end. Some very bad memories came to me, one after another in a row. I heard what I thought was a woman screaming, but that turned out to be peacocks that occupy the courtyard of a church near my brownstone. Then I hauled myself up and I walked to the end of the block. And then I walked one block beyond that, and then another, and then another. Finally, I reached the corner of 9th Street and 8th Avenue, where two groups of women were standing in tight little circles, visibly upset. One young lady, holding a bewildered 2-year-old in her arms, was crying and being heartily consoled by a friend. When I walked by them, they hushed and looked. Beyond them, I had a view all the way down 9th Street toward the water and the horizon. And if I squinted and looked to my right, I thought I could see black smoke rising into the sky, though I could not see downtown. Now, I used to go into Manhattan quite a bit when I was younger, and Manhattan was, of course, where I used to teach. And although I didn't like teaching, I thought of my students and my former colleagues and prayed for their safety and well-being. I thought of you, and felt glad your dreams of living in Manhattan had not come true. I was overwhelmed with sorrow and nostalgia, self-pity and pity for others, which, in me, are often the same emotion. I stood until my feet could no longer bear my own weight, and then I lumbered back, pausing 7 times to catch my breath. The women were gone now, and the streets were empty. At the bottom of my stoop, I looked up to the top of my own 12 steps and vowed that I would not leave again. Because, you see, I had no one to call, and no one called me on that day. And so that's how I knew I did not need to go out of my house anymore.
We've just heard Heft by Liz Moore. Marie-Hélène Bertineau's quirky debut novel, 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas, has been called just the right mix of despair and optimism. Madeline Altomare is a smart-mouthed, rebellious 9-year-old who also happens to be an aspiring jazz singer. Still mourning the recent death of her mom, she doesn't realize that on Christmas Eve, she's about to have the most extraordinary day and night of her life. After bravely facing down mean-spirited classmates and rejection at school, Madeline searches for Philadelphia's legendary jazz club, the Cat's Pajamas, so she can make her onstage debut. On the same day, her fifth-grade teacher, Serena Green, who's just moved back to Philly after a divorce, is nervously looking forward to a dinner party that will reunite her with an old high school crush. And across town at the Cat's Pajamas, club owner Lorca discovers his beloved haunt may have to close forever unless someone can find a way to raise the $30,000 that would save it. As these three lost souls search for love, music, and hope on Philly's snow-covered streets, they will discover life's endless possibilities over the course of one magical night. Angela Gothels narrates.
Like a comet, a horrific afterthought, a roach darts down the wall. Its path follows indecipherable logic. Madeline screams in high C and crushes the cigarette. She pivots, rips a paper towel from a roll on her nightstand. The roach halts, teasing coordinates out of the air with its antennae. It senses her and is rendered paralyzed by options. Madeline closes her eyes, makes the sound of a train whistle on a prairie, and squeezes. 9th Street Market roaches are full and round like tomatoes. This one leaves a mark on the wall, but most of it gets flushed down the toilet. She scrubs her hands, breathes in and out. Every day, more and more roaches. Every time she kills one, Madeline worries she's a bad person. Stop worrying, she instructs herself. It's time to sing. She changes the record and releases the clothespin from her nose. She locks eyes with herself in the mirror and waits for the music to start. Madeline sings. My name is Blossom. I was raised in a lion's den. One hand is perched on her hip while the other swings back and forth, keeping time. Tucked into the mirror of her vanity, a picture of her mother singing. One hand on her hip, the other swinging back and forth in time. Her mother was a dancer and singer whose voice could redirect the mood of a room. My nightly occupation is stealing other women's men. After the cancer spread to her lymph nodes, Madeline's mother filled a recipe box with instructions on how to do various things she knew she wouldn't be around to teach her. How to make a fist, how to change a flat, how to write a thank you note for a gift you hate, how to be efficient. Whenever you are doing one thing, ask yourself, what else could I be doing? On one recipe card, Madeline's mother listed the rules of singing. The number one rule, know yourself. Madeline knows she frowns in the silence between lines. She knows if she straightens her spine, she can hit more notes than if she hunches. She knows she makes up in full-throatedness what she lacks in technical ability. She knows how to harmonize with anything, with someone talking, that harmony is what melody carries in its pocket. She can burrow into a line of music and search out unexpected melodies. She can scat. She knows she scats better if she has eaten a light breakfast. She knows an empty orb hovers inside her, near where the ovaries are drawn on the fold-out in her health textbook. The diaphragm. In the diaphragm, the weather is always 70 degrees and sunny. unable to be shaken even when she shakes. Madeline has trained herself to, when she falters on a high note, clasp the reins of her diaphragm and gather. The song is over. In her flamingo notebook, Madeline marks Blossom's Blues next to Singing. The scatting was flat, but had soul. B minus, she writes. The eggs are ready. She slides them onto a plate and adds a square of toast and a spoonful of jam. She holds her breath as she steps into her father's bedroom. He is sleeping, his back toward her. She clears medicine bottles, an ashtray, a half-empty glass of water, to make space for the plate on his dresser.
We've just heard 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas by Marie-Helene Bertino. Readers, I think you'll agree these quirky characters are utterly endearing and worth your time and attention. For more titles your friends are talking about, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.